but I hated to have humiliated the Maddens with my failure. I felt especially guilty knowing that Mr. Madden had been a friend of Mr. Boran's. I knew how closely their work was related. I could only guess at the questions and the gossip that Miss Sarah was subjected to, and I could not think of a word to say to her as apology. No one told me the story the vile man circulated, but the little I did hear was evil enough to have half the town question the integrity of my character. How I regretted putting this family in such a position. I realized more than ever that I must soon make my own way. I determined to wait until my 17th birthday before I appealed once again to Mrs. Ames. I was hopeful that she might see my need more clearly and be willing to take some steps to help me secure a position as governess. With that in mind, I concentrated more than ever on my studies. Marshall never referred to that night, but embarrassed to think of what he had witnessed, not the least being my near state of undress, I was more reserved with him. He continued to teach the Saturday class and once again joined the family for Saturday dinners. Meg stood by me as always. On a day not long after the ball, Mr. Degott in a snide manner questioned my part in the failed engagement. Meg cut him short by asking him about a particularly ugly piece of gossip that paired him with Mr. Alessi. During that fall and winter, I welcomed my twice-weekly visits to Miss Martha. Her needs were such that mine paled next to hers, and each time I saw her eyes light up at my appearance, it let me know that I had something to offer. Miss Martha was finally responding to treatment. The doctors had discovered that when laudanum was given 4 times a day, rather than just at bedtime, her outbursts all but disappeared. With this improvement, all other treatments were discontinued, and gradually her behavior stabilized. There were times when I spoke to her of my daily affairs and she showed interest, appearing to comprehend my words. I did not include my concerns, but told light-hearted stories based on village gossip. She listened intently, and during the telling often took my hand and stroked it with what I took to be affection. One day when she reached for my hand, I felt such warmth toward her that I wondered if that feeling was akin to what I might feel toward a mother. She noted my mood, and when my eyes welled up, she touched my hand to her face for the first time ever. Following that, my affection for her deepened, and I resolved to continue to see her no matter where my future might take me. May arrived, and with its sweet greening, I tried to convince myself that my future was not as bleak as I had imagined. I still had not written to Belle, for I held a deep hurt that she had not seen fit to tell me the reason for Will's visit, that of securing her for himself. But in truth, it was not the only reason I did not write. I knew there was no chance of returning to the family I loved, and the thought of further contact had become too heart-wrenching. I arranged to meet with Mrs. Ames the day following my 17th birthday. I decided that if she was unable to help me, I would prevail upon the Maddens one last time to assist me in finding a family in need of a governess. Meg was 16, the age when a girl's schooling was considered complete. It was expected that a young woman of that age fill her time with social obligations, but this being Meg, no one questioned when she announced that she would continue her study as before. Although we did not speak of it, Meg assumed I would go on with her, but I had already been given a year's grace. It was time for me to find employment. About a week before my birthday, the mood in the household changed. For no reason that I could understand, the Maddens were more light-hearted in their approach to me. Even Meg, normally oblivious to her parents, noted the difference. I guessed it had to do with their gratitude for my visiting Miss Martha. Indeed, Miss Sarah remarked often how well her sister was doing, and said she was certain it was I who had made all the difference. Over the winter, Marshall had begun to visit on Wednesday evenings to play cards with Meg and me. I remained most grateful for his rescue of me, and because of it I found myself in frequent romantic daydreams that included him. They embarrassed me, and afraid of giving myself away, I was often more reserved with him than I meant to be. When Henry asked to join our midweek card party, I became more my old self. Henry initiated a cautious flirtation with Meg, and I began an easy banter with Marshall. I was melancholy when I returned from the hospital the afternoon of my birthday. The day before, Miss Sarah had asked if there was anything special that I might like to mark the celebration. Nostalgic for the times the twins and I had shared an outdoor meal, I asked if I might take a simple afternoon dinner to share with Miss Martha. Miss Sarah seemed pleased with my request, and after she obtained permission from the hospital, she had Bess prepare a basket. When I arrived, the hospital staff had set up a small table beside a bench in the shade of the mad yard, and I was told that Miss Martha and I had exclusive use of the yard for 1 hour. She was more alert than ever, and she watched closely as I covered the table with a white cotton cloth and set out blue and white china plates and silver cutlery. I had her sit beside me on the bench, then covered our laps with large linen napkins before we began our small feast of pickled asparagus, baked ham, fresh bread, and apple tarts topped with thick sweet cream. She waited until I began to eat, then delicately picked up her cutlery and began to sample the food. While we ate, I spoke of the meals I had enjoyed in the outdoors at Tall Oaks. From the corner of my eye I saw that she listened, so I indulged myself and spoke to her as though she understood everything. I immersed myself in memory and lived again the joy as the twins and I, sated from a basket feast, lay back onto soft pine needles. When I came back to present day, I told my silent dinner companion that this day was my birthday. I was 17, a grown woman. Miss Martha looked at me, dabbed her mouth with her napkin, and for the first time since her hospitalization, spoke a full sentence. "When the captain arrives, Isabel, we will leave for home," she said. I stared at her. I waited for more, but it was as though the effort to formulate the thought had drained her. She looked about as if lost. Her napkin dropped to the ground when she rose from the table, and she did not retrieve it before she walked off. Later, when I said goodbye, she was still far away. I meant to go straight to my room to finish what I had been working on. I was preparing a list of my qualifications for the prospective employer whom I hoped Mrs. Ames would help me to find. When I disembarked from my carriage, I was surprised to find Marshall there to greet me. He took my basket from my arm and set it down. "Walk with me," he asked. "Is Meg coming?" I looked for her.
"No, not today."
"But Miss Sarah?"
"I have her permission."
I might have been apprehensive had he not such a pleasant look. He took my hand and linked it to his arm, then confidently set the two of us out on a path into the golden afternoon. In silence, we walked to the park, where Marshall seated me on a bench under a blooming dogwood tree. I glanced up at him uncertainly.
"Lavinia," he said, facing me, "I understand that you have once again demonstrated your kindness."
I did not understand his meaning and said so.
"I have only recently learned of your visits to the hospital."
"Oh,
what kindness, Lavinia. How extraordinary your loyalty."
"It isn't really so extraordinary, Marshall," I said. "Miss Martha gives me comfort. She reminds me of home. That is, of Tall Oaks."
"And do you consider Tall Oaks your home?"
"It is the only home I remember."
"And it is your birthday today."
I laughed, wondering where this conversation was going. "Yes. I'm 17, I admitted.
"You are aware, then, that today you are a free woman."
I looked at him in surprise. Although I knew I was indentured, I no longer thought of myself in bondage.
"I will have papers drawn up if you like."
"Will they be necessary?" I asked.
"No," he smiled. "Not if you agree to my plan."
I questioned him with a look. He took a deep breath.
"Lavinia, I have a proposal for you."
At once I was filled with enthusiasm. I realized what he was about to suggest. He wanted me as a companion for his mother. He would take the two of us back with him. I fought to control my growing excitement.
This fall, I will inherit Father's estate. By then, I'll have completed my studies, but I won't stay here to practice law. I plan to go back to Tall Oaks to run the plantation myself.
He took a seat beside me.
You must know I care for you. I want you to come with me, Lavinia. I want to marry you.
I was speechless with astonishment. He took my hand.
I've already discussed this with Aunt and Uncle, and both think this a fine match.
Still, I was unable to speak.
Lavinia, he said, you must know how very dear you are to me.
Taking my stunned silence as a negative, he continued.
Please consider my proposal.
Well, yes, I would be honored, I managed to say. In response, he kissed my gloved hand and smiled at me. I reached up to tenderly loose one of his sandy blonde curls, caught under his crisp white shirt collar.
We will be happy, he said,
and he drew me toward him in a warm embrace. I immediately sought Miss Sarah's counsel. What did she think of a marriage between Marshall and me?
You are both young, she said, yet I see your influence on him. He is a happy man when he is with you, Lavinia. I do believe that you bring out the best in him.
I was flattered to hear this.
I know how you long to return to Tall Oaks, she continued, and I'm sure that you are aware of the social advantages this marriage will bring to you.
She stopped, studied her hands, and then looked at me again.
Do you care for Marshall?
Yes, I replied honestly. I do.
Then, she said, Mr. Madden and I are happy to give our blessing.
That same night, I broke my silence and wrote to tell Belle of my good fortune. I was elated. I was coming home. I wrote how happy I was and how grateful I felt to Marshall for his saving me from an unknown future. How I played over my homecoming. Married to Marshall, I would be in a position to cast favor on my waiting family, and I spent many hours daydreaming of how we might improve on their homes and find ways to ease their workload. I took the fantasy so far that I even believed it possible Marshall would give them their freedom one day, as I had been given mine. I did have some concerns about him, but I kept them to myself. He clearly trusted me as he trusted no other, and because of it, I saw his vulnerability, something he hid well from others. He was considerate of me, but if I gave opposition, offering an opinion that differed from his, he took it as a personal offense and would isolate himself in a dark mood. As a consequence, I learned quickly to stand with him on any subject. Fortunately, making myself amenable was not foreign to me, as I had lived this way for much of my life. A lesser worry, yet one that I noted, was Marshall's lack of physical affection. Our social outings were few, though he escorted me twice to theater events. He clearly took pride in having me on his arm, but we did not stay after to socialize. In fact, we came home immediately after, and once I was safely deposited, Marshall soon made an excuse to leave. As his time at university was ending, his need for study time had increased, so our Saturday classes were dropped. He came for evenings of card playing, where Henry and Meg were always at the ready, but he never stayed late, nor did he request to see me alone. In truth, after Mr. Boren's display, I was relieved, yet I wondered why Marshall did not at least attempt a kiss. In many ways, his treatment of me reminded me of the way I had behaved toward the doll that Mama May had given me as a child. I favored it so that I had refused myself the joy of playing with it, daring to love it only with my eyes. But in doing so, I had denied myself its very purpose. Though Meg and I remained steady companions, she was curiously silent about my relationship with Marshall. Sensing her reluctance to discuss the topic, I did not bring up any of my own concerns. In the last week of August, when I was being fitted for 3 new dresses, a gift for my upcoming marriage, compliments of the Maddens, the dressmaker came with the stunning news that Mr. Boran was dead. The town hummed with gossip.
The unfortunate man had been found in the woods, close to a wayside tavern some miles out of town. This tavern, it was rumored, sheltered women who, as Miss Sarah put it, saw to the needs of a certain type of man. What made it curious was that it was well known Mr. Boran did not drink. However, it appeared that he had imbibed so heavily the evening of his death that he had fallen from his horse and fatally struck his head on a rock. My first concern was for his daughter Molly, until I remembered that she had an aunt who loved her well. I could not say that I regretted to hear the news, as I still had fear of the man. Though I had not told the Maddens, I had confided in Marshall that on more than one occasion I was certain I had seen him at night on the street outside my window. Miss Sarah, Meg, and I gossiped wildly, but at dinner that day we were subdued. Mr. Madden, we did not forget, had been a friend to Mr. Boran. I offered my sympathies to him, and though he thanked me, his look was troubled. I wanted desperately to discuss the news with Marshall, so I was disappointed when he sent his regrets and did not visit that week. When I next saw him and raised the subject of Mr. Boran, his comment was dismissive. He was bored with the topic of that miserable man's death, he said, and I knew from his behavior to let the matter rest. Through that summer I continued to visit Miss Martha. She and I did not have conversations as others might know them, but she always appeared interested in what I had to say. If she was particularly drawn to a subject, she often repeated one or two of my words. I knew then to embellish to give further details. I had not spoken to her of Marshall, nor of our relationship, but as our wedding date approached, I knew the time had come. The day I chose to tell her, we sat outside in the shade of the madyard. It was late afternoon and the hot August sun had no mercy for those in the enclosure, but the outdoors provided us the most privacy. "I am going to marry Marshall," I said bluntly. She did not respond. "Miss Martha," I said, for some reason wanting to cry, "do you understand? I am to marry Marshall, your son." She began to pick at the sleeve of my dress. "Marry Marshall," she said in a sing-song voice. "Marry Marshall." I interrupted her as I had learned to do. "Yes," I said. "In September we will marry, and we'll go back to Tall Oaks." "Tall Oaks," she whispered. "Tall Oaks." She lifted her head and stared off as though seeing beyond the wall. "What do you think?" I asked. She turned back to me and smiled, something I had not seen her do in the past 5 years. It touched me so that I began to cry. It was Miss Martha's smile that gave me the courage to plead her case with Marshall. From what I knew, he had not seen her since that unfortunate visit years before with Miss Sarah. I did not tell him that I had knowledge of that time, but instead asked him if he would accompany me on my next visit to his mother.
"I cannot do it."
I heard the pain in his statement and pressed him no further. But I asked him if it was not possible to take her home with us. I promised to be responsible for her care. His initial response was no, but I noted a small hesitation, and the next time I felt the mood right, I remarked on the benefits that Miss Martha would have in her own home, how Mama May and the twins might care for her, and how good food might stimulate her appetite. I was optimistic and said that I thought it possible she might fully recover. I used to my advantage his eagerness to satisfy me, and a few short weeks before our marriage, I won him over. Our wedding ceremony took place in the late afternoon on the 6th of October, 1801. We had meant to have it in the parlor, but the day was so beautiful, the garden still so pretty, and our wedding party so small, that we decided at the last minute to change plans. Meg and Henry stood with us as we took our vows amid the sound of birdsong and the scent of late-blooming honeysuckle. I wore an ivory satin gown, very high-waisted with elbow-length sleeves, and on my feet I had the prettiest pointed slippers ever made. Meg pinned up my hair and nestled in it pearl clips and small rosettes of ivory satin ribbon. About a month before the wedding, in a rare moment of privacy, Marshall had informed me that an account had been set up in my name. Mr. Madden was in charge of it, but I was to use it for the sole purpose of seeing to my needs. When Marshall told me the sum, I was astounded and said I had no need of that amount. He laughed.
You will require all of that and more. I want you to have a new wardrobe.
But I don't need...
This is not about need, Lavinia. You will be my wife, and I want to see you well-dressed. Remember, if this is not a sufficient amount, you have but to ask.
Might I use some of this for gifts?
Again he laughed. You may use it for whatever you like, but promise me I will see a new wardrobe, and don't forget your wedding gown.
On our wedding day, as Mr. Madden led me down the brick walk toward my intended, I looked up to see Marshall's approving smile and was flooded with gratitude. Because of him, my future was secured, and I was going home. After the short ceremony, drinks were made available, and our guests, among them Mr. DeGott, Mr. Alessi, and Mrs. Ames, joined to offer us a toast for a long and happy marriage. Then began a round of individual toasts that ended with everyone very gay indeed. After the sun set, we went into the front parlor, which had been cleared of furniture. Mr. Alessi, with a group of musicians, played music that no one could resist, and soon we were all dancing joyfully. I was pleased to see that Marshall handled the drink as well as any of us. As a matter of fact, it relaxed him as it did me, and the two of us laughed and teased each other as though we were children. Later, Miss Sarah called us all into the dining room, where we enjoyed a feast that Nancy and Bess had prepared over the last few days. By 11 o'clock that evening, everyone had left. Marshall and I stayed that night with the Maddens, and we all soon retired, each to our separate rooms. Marshall and I slept apart. He had suggested we get a good rest before the start of our journey the following morning. In bed that night, when I reflected back to the joy of the day, I could not sleep. Added to that was the excitement of going home. We left early the next morning, our coach piled high. Meg and I clung to each other until Marshall teased that he would leave without me. Meg ran into the house when I climbed into the carriage, and I didn't look back to wave at the Maddens for fear of my own tears beginning. When we drew up to the public hospital, another coach waited, with Miss Martha already settled in. Two hospital attendants were with her for the journey. After we reached Tall Oaks and their patient was settled, they would return to Williamsburg. Words could not express what I felt that morning. The other carriage led the way, and as it left, our ready horses bolted. Distracted, I flew off the seat. Marshall's quick embrace caught me, or I would have been thrown. I turned into his arms and met his eyes, then surprised us both when I kissed his mouth. I sat back and blushed while he chuckled quietly. We were on our way. We were going home. A profound gladness overtook me. Tears of joy filled my eyes, and I looked out the window through prisms of color as Williamsburg faded away.
Chapter 36. Belle. We don't hear from Lavinia for a long time, until she writes that now she's going to marry Marshall. I don't write back. What do I say? What happened to the other man? How do you get with Marshall? What are you thinking to marry Marshall? I say to Mama, maybe this'll turn out good, but Mama don't like it. Nothing good gonna come from this, she says. That boy got trouble coming his way, and I don't like to think that Lavinia gonna be part of it. I start to worrying about Marshall getting at me again, but Will Stevens says that I'm his now, and Marshall got no say over me. Will says he's got one more year to run this place, then we're going to his farm down a mile from the quarters, other side of the creek. I know his farm's gonna work out good, 'cause since Will's here, Ben and Papa say this place is doing the best it ever do. One day after we get Lavinia's letter, the Maddens sent a wagon load of crates from Williamsburg. Will Stevens takes them up to the big house, and we're all there while he opens them up. We stand back, nobody saying nothing. when he pulls out the red and white paper to put up on the walls. Papa helps him unwrap two new red chairs, and then bolts of cloth that looks like the color of top cream and feels soft like my own skin. When they're done, Will reads us the letter from Mrs. Madden that tells us to put all of this in a bedroom for Lavinia. Fanny's wondering if this is why Lavinia's going to marry Marshall, that she's wanting all these pretty things. If that's why she's marrying him, I say, she sure is changed. The only time I ever see Lavinia wanting something for herself was the time she took Beattie's baby doll. And then she was just looking for something to love. Will says he got orders for us to move Marshall's bedroom down to the good parlor. We don't ask no questions. We just work hard to get everything done like the letter says. The big house looks as good as when Miss Martha leaves, and we're all wondering if she's coming back. Her room's ready for her, if she do. Everybody knows a big change is coming. Fanny, Beattie, Suki. They're all watching for the carriage every day. Me too. But Ben says if Marshall ever touches me again, he's a dead man. I never did see Mama this quiet before.
Chapter 37. Lavinia. It was a long journey home. In spite of the experienced attendants, I was required to travel in Miss Martha's coach for extended periods of time. I learned quickly that Marshall had little patience for his mother, though I noted he had planned ahead to meet her needs. At every tavern stop along the way, she was immediately taken to her room, where her attendants cared for her until the following morning. At great cost, I was provided with my own room. I did wonder why Marshall did not join me. I knew he often spent the nights in a communal room with other travelers. Each day became more difficult for Miss Martha. On our last day of travel, I knew it would be easiest for her if I spent the full day in her carriage, so that morning I urged Marshall to saddle his own horse and ride ahead. I could see his relief at my suggestion, and he did not wait to do exactly that. In the late afternoon, with Miss Martha finally sleeping, we drove up the long drive that led to Tall Oaks. The green boxwood on either side of the winding road had grown tall, and when the grand house came into view, it glistened with a fresh coat of whitewash. As we pulled up, I saw smoke rise from the kitchen house, and I could scarcely keep from leaping out. I felt certain everyone would be at the big house waiting to greet me, and was disappointed to see only Papa George out front. When he opened the coach door and helped me down, I reached to embrace him, but he deftly stepped back. He must have recognized my hurt, for he held tight to my gloved hand and gave me a small, formal bow. He pretended to look into the carriage before he asked,
"Did you see Miss Lavinia? They say she coming home."
"Oh, Papa," I laughed. "You know this is me."
"My, my."
He looked at me and shook his head.
"Miss Lavinia come back to us, and now she a lady."
"I'm the same as ever, Papa," I looked around. "Where is everyone?" Before he could answer, Mama May came through the front door. I forgot all about Miss Sarah's proper decorum and called out Mama's name as I raced up the steps to greet her. I threw my arms around her, and though she did not discourage my embrace, she did not prolong it. I would have worried at this had I not seen another's sparkling eyes over Mama May's shoulder. I doubt I would have recognized Fanny if it hadn't been for her familiar eyes. At 17, with a broad forehead and prominent teeth, she remained as plain as ever. She had grown tall and was very thin, but what so changed her appearance was the head rag she wore. I was used to seeing her black hair, usually in braids, framing her face. The wrap of dark navy did nothing to flatter her deep brown color. "Fanny," I called out, as I crossed the threshold and went toward her. From the corner of my eye I saw Mama give Fanny a nod. Fanny stepped back to execute an odd attempt at a curtsy.
"Miss Lavinia, it's so good to have you back home with us."
I thought her formality a joke, and would have laughed had the exhausted attendants not then appeared with Miss Martha. Their patient was confused and upset, and to my disappointment, she did not recognize home. Mama, Fanny, and I took Miss Martha to her room. I measured out her next laudanum dose, and as it took effect, Mama and Fanny readied her for bed. While she settled, I looked around and saw how everything shone. I complimented Mama and Fanny on how well the house had been cared for. Mama smiled.
"You gonna be the fine young mistress," she said.
"Oh, Mama," I said, "don't call me that."
"That who you be now," she said. "When he come home this morning, Master Marshall make it clear that we to call you the mistress."
Embarrassed, I didn't know how to respond. My face burned.
"Avinya,"
Mama said softly to me.
"That name don't mean nothing. Everybody here know who you are to them. Don't you worry about that."
Fanny nodded her agreement. When Miss Martha slept, Mama told me to go downstairs where Marshall waited for me in the dining room. I had little hunger, though by now it was supper time. When I got to the dining room, Marshall was already seated. I saw Uncle Jacob waiting by the table.
"Uncle!"
I rushed in joyously until I caught Marshall's eye. His look cooled me and I slowed to a walk. Once seated, I turned to Uncle.
"How are you, Uncle Jacob?" I asked.
"I just fine, Miss Avinya," he said.
His eyes did not meet mine, and I was reminded of the coolness of the servants in Miss Sarah's home. Before I could attempt further conversation, Marshall broke in with talk of the plantation and his ideas for the future. At the end of the meal, Beatty came to clear the table. Although she, too, was wearing a head rag, hers was a pretty yellow, and I would have known her anywhere. She was shorter than Fanny, but her body was more curvaceous. Her gentle brown eyes shone, and when she smiled, she was as beautiful as I remembered. I rose to go to her, but Marshall caught my hand and frowned. Reluctantly, I reseated myself.
"Beatty,"
I said,
"how are you?"
"I just fine, Avinya."
She glanced at Marshall, then corrected herself.
"Miss Avinya."
Marshall asked Uncle for more wine, and Beatty took that moment of distraction to give me another smile. My eyes followed her when she left the dining room, and as the door swung open, I caught a glimpse of another young girl peeking through. This time I could not stop myself. I pushed my chair back from the table, ran to the door, and flung it open. The child's hair was braided, and she was without a head rag. She had a full pink mouth, a round face, and large, serious eyes. She fingered the embroidered pink edging on the collar of her brown homespun shift, no doubt some of Beatty's handiwork. I went through the door and let it close behind me.
"Suki?"
I asked, unmindful that I knelt on my best traveling dress.
"Is this Suki?"
She nodded shyly.
"Don't you remember me?"
"You my Binny,"
she said, and the world stopped when she came into my arms. Marshall flung open the door with such force that, startled, we pulled apart. He looked at me strangely, then nodded at Suki.
"Who is that?"
he asked.
"This is Suki."
I stood and put my arm around her shoulders. "I've known her since she was a baby."
"Lavinia," said Marshall, "I've had enough. It has been a long trip. Could we finish our meal without further histrionics?"
I obediently released Suki but whispered in her ear, "I'll see you later," before I followed Marshall into the dining room. There, my new husband and I finished our first meal at home in awkward silence. I did not need Marshall's encouragement to retire early. I was told that I would have the room opposite the nursery, what had been the tutor's room. I remembered it as dark and fearsome, and though Mama knew my trepidation, she led me to it nonetheless. When she opened the door, I gasped in amazement at the change I saw before me. A red and ivory toile covered the walls. while the two tall windows and the four-poster bed were curtained in ivory damask. Two small wing-back chairs were upholstered in red silk and set invitingly in front of the fireplace. A small fire burned, and across the room, on a small writing desk, an oil lamp flickered, illuminating two of Meg's botanical prints. Mama looked at me hopefully. "It's beautiful, Mama," I said, determined to show my appreciation. But everything felt wrong. Since my arrival, I had felt an uneasiness taking over, and somehow this room epitomized that disquiet. This did not feel like my home. True, it was lovely, but it did not feel like the home I remembered, the one I had envisioned. My homecoming was nothing I had hoped for. Mama smiled at me as if to ease her next words.
"You don't call me Mama no more. You best call me May. Master Marshall say that what he want."
I frowned. Mama spoke softly.
"This all gonna take some getting used to.
But you know we all standing by you."
Fanny came to the door to ask for Mama's help with Miss Martha. I wanted to go with them, but Mama told me no.
"Tonight we take care of her," she said. "You stay here."
Fanny peeked in before she left.
"Abinia, how you like your room? We all worked to get it right for you."
"Oh, it's beautiful, Fanny," I said, as sincerely as I was able. After she closed the door, I wandered the room, then settled on the edge of the bed. I stayed there for a long time until, overcome with loneliness, I crossed over to the window. My room was adjacent to Miss Martha's rooms, and when I looked out on the familiar backyard, there was enough moonlight to see the kitchen house and the path that led to Mama and Papa's cabin. I could make out the barns, and when I thought I saw smoke rising from a chimney down at the quarters, I breathed in deeply. "I'm home," I whispered, hugging myself. "I'm home." Later that night, after I was already in bed, Marshall came to my room. He had been drinking since supper, and it was easy to see that he had overindulged. He came into my room carrying a beaker half filled with brandy, and on his way to me, he stumbled and spilled a good portion of it on one of the red silk chairs. I would have rushed to clean it, but something told me it was better left alone. I was tense, for we had not yet been intimate. I wondered if he was as virginal as I, but when he discarded his clothes and pulled me to him, I did not wonder further. The act was quick and rough, and he showed no tenderness. But after, when I pulled my gown down, he laid his head on my stomach and drunkenly pleaded for my forgiveness. I fingered his curls and stroked his head, soothing him until he slept. I wanted desperately to ease away, to run down to the kitchen house to see Belle, but I did not. True, I feared to wake my husband, but there was another reason, one that had haunted me throughout the past year. I could not bear to see Will Stevens sharing Belle's home. I sat awake and watched the light from the fireplace die down. Engulfed in darkness, I admitted to myself that perhaps, in thinking this marriage would return me to my family, I had made a dreadful mistake. When I awoke late the next morning, I saw that Marshall had left a note saying he and Will Stevens had gone out to survey the farm. He would be back to join me for a 2 o'clock dinner. I dressed quickly and went directly to Miss Martha's room. Mama met me in the blue room and fussed over me, telling me to go down to eat, or did I want a tray upstairs? "Please stop, Mama," I said. "Please don't trouble yourself with me. You know I can take care of myself."
"You call me May," she said firmly.
I didn't answer. "How is Miss Martha?" I asked.
"Come see for yourself,"
Mama said. Miss Martha was already seated in a chair with Suki combing her hair. A breakfast tray was pushed to the side, and from all appearances, the patient had eaten a good breakfast.
"Isabel,"
Miss Martha said when she saw me, and I was delighted to see how alert and happy she appeared. I went to her and gave her a hug. Then I put my arm around Suki's shoulders.
"Hello, baby," I said,
and we laughed as we hugged. Mama, I asked, can you spare us if we go down to the kitchen house for a while? Mama didn't answer. Mama? I asked again. Miss Abinya, Mama said, you call me May. I stood my ground. No, Mama, I said. I won't. I had never defied her, and we both looked at each other in surprise. Mama turned and walked out to the blue room. I followed, leaving Suki and Miss Martha in the bedroom.
You call me May, she said.
No, I said. Child, I raise you up, and I saying that you gonna call me May. No, Mama, I pleaded. Mama sat down on a wooden chair and waited a while before she looked up at me. Why you do this to me, child? She asked. Because you are Mama. I began to cry, the stress of the previous day and night fueling my tears. Mama stood and I went to her open arms. Nothing's the same, Mama, I cried. Nothing's the same. She pulled a rough handkerchief from her pocket and wiped my face.
This all gonna work out, she said.
This need time, that's all. You go on now. You take Suki down to the kitchen, and I stay here. Somebody down there waiting on you.
Belle, coming up from the orchard, balanced a large basket of apples on her shoulder. A young boy of 4 or 5 circled her, tossing an apple in the air. I hesitated, then increased my pace. When Belle caught sight of me, she placed the basket on the ground, called my name, and ran to greet me. We embraced until Belle held me away to see how I had grown. Suki brought the little boy to me.
You knows Jamie? She asked,
pulling him forward. Why, yes, I certainly do. I had known him only as a babe, but when I crouched down, I could scarcely believe what I saw. His sandy-colored hair had a soft curl, and his blue eyes looked out from a face that might have been Campbell's. However, I immediately noted that his left eye was clouded over, and from the way he held his head to look at me, it was clear that his vision was impaired. Hello, Jamie, I took his hand. The last time I saw you, you were just a wee one. He pulled away from me and ran to Belle. She patted his head.
He never sees no lady before.
She sent him on ahead with Suki, then put her arm through mine as we made our way toward the kitchen. There, Beatty was preparing dinner. She continued her work when we came in, but when I offered to help, she invited me to sit. Soon Fanny came from the big house, where Mama had relieved her of her duties so she could join our reunion. Suki sat next to me, and I put my arm around her shoulder as she put hers around my waist. I felt a tenderness toward her that I might have felt toward my own child. It wasn't long before we all began to talk at once, and soon the kitchen rocked with our laughter. So there in the kitchen house, I finally felt some of what I had been longing for. But it was short-lived. Mama was short of breath when she appeared at the door.
Come.
She waved to us, looking back toward the barns.
They back, and Master Marshall coming up soon.
We could not miss the anxiety in her voice, and we all responded at once. Beatty and Belle went back to their work in the kitchen, while Fanny, Suki, and I quickly followed Mama up to the big house.
Chapter 38, Belle. When Lavinia was a child, every time you turn around, she's sick. Somebody looks at her the wrong way, her food comes up. Most of the time, Mama and me don't think she's going to live to grow up. How this girl comes back looking good as she do, I don't know. Now she's taller than me. She stands straight up, and when she walks, she moves almost like her feet off the ground. Her bones still look like they'd break easy, but she's filled out enough to look like a woman. Her hair's dark, but it's still red, no question about that. She talks like before. Soft and quiet, but now she's got a way of saying things that let you know she's a lady. Mama says it's hard to believe. But if you see her standing next to Miss Martha, except for the eyes, she looks just like her. The first time I see Marshall, he's going down to the barns, and I jump back so he don't see me. Suki and Jamie are playing outside, and Marshall walks right up to them. He don't say nothing, just keeps looking at Jamie like he don't believe what he sees. I know it's like he's looking back at himself. I go out and call to Jamie to come to the kitchen house. Marshall looks up and watches Jamie run to me. My hands are shaking so bad they hardly work to close the door. Then I got to sit down. That's how much that man scares me. I know I'm going to Will's farm, but until I get there, I sleep with one eye open and the kitchen knife under my bed. I know that Mama and Papa want me and Ben to get out of here before something happens. Ben don't think like Papa. Papa says Ben got to know his place. But Ben says he knows his place all right, and it ain't under no white man that don't do right. Marshall's home only for a few days, but already he's got everybody feeling skittery. It's like you know a storm's coming, and lightning's bound to strike.
Chapter 39, Lavinia. At dinner on our second day, I was alarmed at my husband's bad temper. As Uncle quietly served the delicious meal that Belle and Beatty had prepared, I tried to eat. Finally, my stomach churning, I set down my cutlery and began to nervously smooth the heavy linen napkin that covered my lap, as I listened with growing apprehension to the railings of my young husband. Will Stevens, he said, had made a mess of the plantation. Oh, Stevens was good enough with words, and he had fooled Uncle Madden in Williamsburg, but one only had to look for oneself to see how poorly the place had been run. Marshall interrupted himself only once.
"Jacob," he instructed, "bring us another bottle of wine."
I saw a momentary look of surprise on Uncle Jacob's face. I reached for Marshall's hand. "Might that wait until tonight's supper?" I asked. But when Marshall hastily withdrew his hand, I realized my mistake. When Uncle left for the cellar, Marshall turned to me, his face set.
"Don't you ever speak over me again, Lavinia," he said.
"Marshall, I didn't mean—"
"I don't care what you meant," he interrupted. "You are my wife. You do not question me."
I searched his furious face and found no opening for reason. When Uncle Jacob returned and began to pour the wine, Marshall insisted my glass be filled as well. He drank two glasses of wine in quick succession, then sat back and observed me after he had Uncle fill his glass a third time. Too anxious to introduce a new topic of discussion, I made an effort to resume eating. When my cutlery accidentally scratched against the china, I glanced up in apology and was surprised to see that my husband's mood had changed. He gave me a pleasant smile, raised his glass, and nodded for me to join him.
"Let us drink a toast, Lavinia," he said.
I forced myself to smile when I held my glass up to his.
"To us, Lavinia,"
he said.
"May we always be this happy."
Marshall did not come to my room that night, but he did the next, and again he was inebriated. He was not gentle, and the act was not pleasant for me. However, I knew my responsibility, and did not think to deny him. In fact, I had hoped that our coming together might be a way to establish a closer bond. Soon, though, I realized that for Marshall it was not an act of intimacy. Rather, it was a function to be done when intoxicated. In the weeks that followed, when he did visit, he did not stay the night, but left soon after he finished. Alone then, I lay awake, wondering what had happened to the Marshall I had known back in Williamsburg. Morning was Marshall's best time. He rose early, eager and ambitious to begin the day, but at dinner he began to drink, and his mood usually turned sour. Seldom was his frustration with me, for I anticipated his needs and always acquiesced if necessary. However, as the days passed, his anger escalated toward Will Stevens. I began to dread our daily afternoon meal, when his tirades against Will began, I took comfort in having the security of Uncle Jacob's constant presence in the dining room, and in Beatty, who came to serve the food. Often when she lifted or set a plate, she brushed my hand or caught my eye, and I was reminded that I was not alone. A few weeks after our homecoming, Beatty wore the gold locket I had brought back for her as a gift from Williamsburg. Marshall noted it, and after a few glasses of wine, asked in a friendly manner who had given it to her.
"Miss Lavinia," she said proudly.
"Miss Lavinia," he said as he turned toward me. "And where did your mistress get the funds for such a fine gift?"
"From you, Marshall," I smiled at him.
"From the money you gave me in Williamsburg. You said I could buy gifts if I chose."
His face turned hard.
"Naturally. I assumed you meant Uncle, Aunt, or Meg."
"But you said..."
"And who else in this household benefited from my generosity?"
"Marshall, please. You are embarrassing me."
"Who else?"
he shouted. I shook my head, refusing to answer.
"Give it to me,"
he directed Beatty, who removed her gift with trembling fingers. He slipped it into his waistcoat pocket and stood to deliver a final dictate to me.
"You are never to buy gifts for the servants without my approval. They are your servants. For God's sake, Lavinia, try to elevate yourself to your new station."
After he left the room, Beatty and I looked at each other, both of us shaken.
"I'm sorry,"
I said to Beatty.
"It all right, Miss Abinia,"
she said as she cleared the dishes, then left the room. As I sat at the table alone, I was reminded of the day Miss Martha first played her harpsichord for me. She spoke of loneliness, and this day I understood her position as never before. But with that memory, I became determined to establish a better relationship with Marshall and to find again the friendship that we had shared in Williamsburg. Then would I appeal to him for the needs for my family. Mama May tried to guide me into the role of mistress. It was her idea that we set aside time to inventory the house, to go through each room in empty cupboards and chests, drawers, and linen presses, and to make a complete list of the household's belongings. Mama suggested I tell Marshall of this undertaking, to let him know how I was spending my time. I did so, and when I saw his approval, I knew that Mama understood my role, and perhaps my husband, better than I. Soon a good part of my day was taken up with sorting through the house. I helped care for Miss Martha, and in the afternoons I took pleasure in reading to her. Some mornings after I was sure Marshall had left the yard, I ran down for a quick visit to the kitchen house. I knew that those times made Mama uneasy, but I went nonetheless, always hoping to see Belle on her own. She was the one I thought might answer the intimate questions I had about my marriage. But the few times I saw her, others were always with us, plying me with questions about my life in Williamsburg. We had been home no more than a month, and a routine of dinner drinking had already been established. Without my knowledge, Marshall must have observed me on a morning visit to the kitchen house. At dinner that afternoon, my husband nodded for Uncle to refill his glass. Then he took my hand.
"So, Lavinia," he said not unpleasantly, "what have you been doing today?"
"Mama and I are doing an inventory of the nursery," I said quickly. Marshall squeezed my hand, and I realized too late the trap.
"But you were down in the kitchen house. I don't want you down there, do you understand?"
I tried to pull my hand away, but he continued to press with force. His eyes gleamed at my discomfort.
"But Mama and—"
I whispered, glancing back at Uncle Jacob.
"Mama,"
he spat out the word.
"You are my wife. She is May to you."
"Marshall, you're hurting me."
He continued to squeeze, and I gasped from pain as I tried to free my hand.
"I said you call her May. Did you hear me?"
"Yes," I moaned.
When Uncle Jacob slipped from the room, I wanted to call out for him not to leave, but dared not. Fortunately, Marshall had released me by the time Uncle returned. I sat stunned, my hand throbbing, while my husband resumed eating. Suddenly Mama burst into the room.
"Excuse me, Master Marshall. Miss Abinia,
I need you for helping with Miss Martha."
When she dashed from the room, I rose alarmed. "I must go," I said, and followed quickly. I rushed up the stairs behind Mama, and when we reached the blue room, she hastily shut the door behind us, then sent me into the bedroom while she stayed behind. Miss Martha, seated in her chair, smiled contentedly at me. Fanny stood by her but studied me anxiously. The three of us jumped when we heard loud bangs from the blue room. Fanny and I rushed out to find Mama banging a wooden chair against the floor.
"Mama!"
I couldn't imagine what she was doing. She put her fingers to her lips, then whispered for Fanny and me to run back into the bedroom.
"Like this," she said,
stomping both of her feet.
"Go, go!"
She waved us away. Fanny ran heavily, and I wondered if they had both gone mad. Uncle Jacob knocked at the door.
"Master Marshall wantin' to know if he got to send for the doctor."
"No," Mama said. "You tell him that we just need a little time, that's all."
When she came to me, she raised my arm to inspect my swollen hand, and I finally understood.
"We gonna have to soak this," she said.
"How did you know?" I whispered.
"He rang that,"
Mama said. She pointed to the bell and tapestry panel hanging beside Miss Martha's bed. I knew there was a system interconnected throughout the house, but in my experience, it had never been used.
"If this rang more than one time, we know that Uncle Jacob calling for us. We always here to help."
Mama's firm look held my eyes.
"You understand this?" she said.
I nodded. She smoothed my hand.
"Why he do this?"
"I'm not to go down to the kitchen house." I fought back tears.
"And I must call you May."
Mama gave me a long look, and unshed tears burned my throat.
"It just a name," Mama said. "But when you calls me Mama, it's saying too much. You call me May, and I come fast as when you call me Mama. The same thing with Papa. You call him George. He Papa to you, that we know, but Master Marshall don't see it like that."
When I could speak, I gave Mama my word that I would do as she asked. Life became increasingly uneasy as winter approached. Marshall continued with too much drink at dinner, and I no longer dared to go to the kitchen house to see Belle. Almost always, once he was inebriated, Marshall's focus turned to Will Stevens. The final break between Marshall and Will took place on a hog-killing day in early December. It seemed that Will had promised everyone a feast of fresh pork and a drink of brandy when they finished. Marshall took strong objection, seeing it as an extravagance, though Will argued that the workers not only anticipated it, but deserved it. Marshall cited this as an example of Will's excess and mismanagement of the farm. When Marshall came for dinner that day, he drank much and ate little. I tried to soothe him, but my comments only seemed to feed his agitation. Why was I standing up for Will Stevens and going against my own husband, he demanded. Was it Will Stevens I was more concerned about? My face flushed at the suggestion, and with that, I gave Marshall new fuel.
"So, you have an interest in Will Stevens, is that it?" he shouted.
I remained silent, but I could not control the burning of my face. I had seen Will Stevens only twice since my arrival, both times when he was still employed by Marshall. The first time was of an early morning, scarcely a week into my return. I was brushing out Miss Martha's hair, and Fanny was changing the linens on the bed. I had turned to draw the blinds up to let in the full measure of daylight, when I caught a glimpse of Will as he came out of the horse barn. He was with Ben, and they were laughing. Fury, such as I had seldom felt before, flooded me, and when I turned back to Miss Martha, I could scarcely control my anger. How dare he be so happy? Fanny took note and came to look out the window for herself.
"That's Will Stevens walking with Ben,"
she said plainly, as though wondering what had so affected me.
"For heaven's sake, Fanny,"
Anyone can see that. You remembers what you say when you lil?
I was silent, remembering all too well.
You always say you gonna marry that boy.